Welcome to MacGuffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is the prize-fighting kangaroo known as James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themacguffman.com, to keep up on our most recent episodes. Last week, we talked about Gattaca. A couple weeks before that, we talked about the NBA Finals. And previous to that, we talked about pop star Never Stop Never Stopping, which I am going to never stop mentioning because it's a fun title. Follow us on Twitter, at themacguffman. Tell your friends, tell any alternate reality versions of yourself that may or may not exist. I don't know. Theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yeah.
Here we are. Or are we?
Yeah, no, we're here.
What is life?
We are here doing week two in our series of movies with character names impossible to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking that same thing. But yeah.
The only way to follow up Gattaca is with Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, exactly.
notably a David Lynch film. Mm-hmm. I mean, directors are always notable, but I feel like this one, even more so, his name gets mentioned almost every time this movie gets mentioned, and I think for fair reason.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of a genre on his own, you know, like they're,
yeah.
And I mean, he's made movies that don't fit into that genre. Like The Straight Story is a very not David Lynchy movie. The Elephant Man is only kind of David Lynchy, I would say, or Lynchian. And the Coen brothers kind of have this same sort of thing. I would say to a slightly lesser extent, just because their films are less extreme. But, you know, like Blue Velvet and Eraserhead are a certain kind of picture, and that picture is called Lynchian.
Yeah, and as I think you just said there, this certainly falls into the side of the category that is strongest, I mean, in relation to the things that he's known for doing, right?
Yeah, yes, I would agree. Mm-hmm. I saw somebody refer to it as a hard Lynch movie. And yeah. Like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's worth mentioning that this is 2001, and even just Eraserhead was what, 77?
Yes, yeah, so around there for sure. I don't know the exact year off the top of my head, but
yeah, so I mean, this is 20 years into it, so I mean, he's certainly found himself, but things get more or less Lynchian throughout that career, right? It's not kind of gradually stepping towards this, or do you think that's the case?
No, there are ebbs and flows, right? Because Eraserhead is full Lynch, and then he kind of takes a little bit a step back to The Elephant Man, because Eraserhead is so abstract and a really good movie. Like, I think it might be my favorite movie about being terrified of becoming a father, which is not something I've experienced, but after watching Eraserhead, never want to. And The Elephant Man is, I think it was even nominated for Best Picture. Like, it's conventional enough that it's a David Lynch movie that can be very well regarded from people that, to that point, hadn't really figured out what to do with David Lynch movies. And then there's the failure of Dune, which he had to rein in a little bit of his impulses for that movie, just because it was a big budget movie that ended up failing. And then Blue Velvet, sort of like his independent, I'm going to go home and make my little movie where I get to do what I want. And so, like, there are ebbs and flows like that all throughout his career, right? And you get him when he goes to television to Twin Peaks. There are certain things that he loves doing, like certain gross things that he loves showing that you just can't show on TV. I mean, Twin Peaks, they still got away with a number of surprising things, given that it was the early 90s in primetime television. But yeah, his career has always ebbed and flowed. But the Mulholland Drive, David Lynch, is the Lynch I always sort of come back to in my mind. Like, it feels like that's the real David Lynch, if there can be a real David Lynch, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like that would be the general view of it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think unquestionably his best three films are Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, and Mulholland Drive, and that seems to be the consensus. And those are all movies that have sort of there is some sort of commonality running between all three of those, and so that's kind of where I get to with that. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you mentioned that Elephant Man was kind of normal enough to be nominated, but this he got nominated for Best Director for Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, but the difference is 1980 and 2001, right? He's so much less like he's not getting nominated in 1980 for being David Lynch. He's getting nominated for, well, I don't know that he got nominated. I don't know that it necessarily got nominated for Best Picture. I feel like I'm right about that, but I might be wrong. But like that was sort of a movie that had sort of these prestige elements, whereas where if there were like a few makeup effects that were changed in that movie, you could watch that movie without realizing it was a David Lynch movie. Whereas by 2001, the what we've been talking about, that Lynchian genre, that exists, you know, and everybody knows what it is. And it's almost like it's not quite Denzel Washington in Training Day type of thing. Like we should recognize this, that he's built a career on doing stuff like this, and we should reward it. But it's that sort of thing where it's like we understand what you're doing, even though it took us a couple decades.
Yeah.
And we now realize that what you're doing is really impressive and cool and unique. And here is this token nomination for doing it in a very impressive way this time.
Yeah, and not just that kind of that tokenism that this isn't good, but you've done so many other good things in the past, and this is the chance to make up for it. Just sometimes the scope of history allows you to see a bit more clearly what kind of how original and how talented he was. Is that the
yeah exactly? Okay. And it's also a different side of the same coin of what we talked about in the Hail Caesar podcast, which is a movie I loved and seemingly nobody else did. And you asked me if maybe I'm giving the Coens too much credit, and it's like, yeah, I might be, because I've seen the majority of their other films and I know how they make movies, and they've earned the benefit of the doubt, you know, that this is a movie that is telling me something, whether or not I get it immediately. I feel like these guys have done enough to make me think, yeah, there's something here. And you could say the same with David Lynch. Like if a 1980 version of Mulholland Drive comes out, I don't know what critics would do with it, you know, like, because it is a combination of the abstract and reality, whereas Eraserhead was just full on abstract, you know? So it was easier to kind of classify knowing that you never had to bounce between all of these different sort of headspaces, you know?
Yeah, I told someone that I was watching Mulholland Drive, and they asked me if I had seen it before, and I said, I think I've seen it, or I've seen part of it, or because I have a few clear memories of certain parts of it, but that might have just been watching a clip from it or being shown part of it in a film class or something like that. So I was like, you know, I don't know if I've seen it, but I have these kind of weird, jumbled memories of it. And I mean, that could have meant I watched it this morning, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
After watching it again, I realized why that is, that I could have seen the whole thing and that's still what I took from it. And that's not to say that this movie is just a thrown together clusterfuck or anything, but it's out there.
yeah for sure. Well, I remember the first time I watched this movie, I mean, it was a decade ago, slightly less than a decade ago, and I had never to that point in my life been high. And at the end of the movie, which I loved watching the movie, and it was the first time I'd seen a David Lynch movie and had no idea what the hell it was about at the end, but at the end the first thing I thought as the credits started rolling was like, that must be what getting high feels like. And years later, after I have experienced it, kind of is. Like, you know, it's just such an entertaining movie that I don't quite know what to make of, but know that I love it, you know?
Yeah, that's an odd feeling though, right?
Oh, very, very much so. But it's also something that it's the type of feeling that I find very rewarding, you know? I mean, I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast, the movies that I like the most are the movies that I start to figure out on the walk home, you know? Like, if I see the director's title card at the end of the movie and I already have the movie figured out, it's not going to be one of my favorite movies. You know, like it could be a good movie, it could be an interesting movie, but I need to be able to still be thinking about it on the walk home, as opposed to walking out of the theater thinking about what album I'm going to listen to for that walk. You know what I mean?
Yep. No, that makes sense.
And Mulholland Drive absolutely falls into that category.
Well, yeah, I've walked home after seeing it, and I'm still haven't quite figured it out yet. So it definitely it reaches the point of, in that category for sure.
Absolutely.
So where do you want to start with this?
I don't know. Well, I do want to know if you enjoyed this movie.
I honestly don't know. Okay. I have.
I think that's an okay. That's an assessment that I will live with.
Yeah, see, I try not to read too much about the movies that we talk about before watching them, at least. Obviously, mm-hmm. I do a lot of research after watching them and before talking about them. This movie ended, and I immediately went to go reading about it. I don't know if I just didn't give myself enough time to formulate an opinion on it, and maybe reading some of these positive things, of which there are a lot of positive things as well as a lot of negative things said about this movie in the zeitgeist. But you're supposed to like it is the kind of the takeaway, that if you think you know movies, you're supposed to like it. Mm-hmm. So there are certain elements I really enjoy undeniably while watching this, and there's a couple neat little tricks that we'll get to that I think could work in another film really well, and it doesn't have to be Mulholland Drive, but there's some things that I really like that he does from a filmmaking standpoint in this one. And I mean, just even the scene in the first scene in Winkies where they're discussing the dreams and stuff, you get hooked in really quickly, or I did at least, and I found myself ready to enjoy this movie, not just because I know other people do. Mm-hmm. And there are moments that are more or less enjoyable. And I just don't know who I would recommend this movie to. And I don't know when I'll watch it again, but I imagine I will.
Yeah.
So there's my tepid huzzah for this movie.
Yeah, that was the quote on the front cover of the DVD I watched. Tepid huzzahs.
Tepid huzzahs.
With no, a period, no exclamation mark.
Right. It's kind of the same thing that you're saying, though. If something gives you something to think about, if I just hated it, I would stop thinking about it. And I know that that's not the case.
Yeah.
It's just so much different, and maybe I'm just not watching enough Lynch or experimental films to have a good yardstick for it, but it's definitely undeniably intriguing.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the thing that's so good about the way that David Lynch operates in this sort of these very abstract type movies that he makes is that he does still make them at the core, like, very entertaining movies. Like, I can only assume one of your favorite parts of this movie, because it's one of my favorite parts of the movie, is the guy in the office building that kills the one guy with the book and then has to kill two more other people and sets the building on fire. Like, that scene is on its own just an incredibly funny, entertaining scene. And there's lots of little dashes of things that anybody can find entertaining just because David Lynch is a funny filmmaker, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you put that scene in any Coen Brothers movie and it's in the top 15% of that movie for being mm-hmm. funny and for being Coen-y. Mm-hmm. The moment where they're sneaking back to Diane's place, I think, is just, even without much context, well, I think that's what makes those parts of the movie strongest, is the lack of context. But yeah, that's just a well put together scene that really just gets an immediate reaction from you. And, you know, another set piece of when Adam, the director, is being told who he needs to put in his movie, yeah, and there's the espresso and everything. That's the same thing. You could put that in a Coen movie or a lot of other movies, and it's just a good little scene on its own. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, undeniably he can write well and direct well. And the pieces are there. And it's, I don't know, I think it just depends on how you feel about having just good pieces and not being, not having them form a super cohesive narrative, which is not something he was trying to do and failed by any means, just a choice that was clearly made.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I like to say, I think the gateway drug to David Lynch is Blue Velvet, because that's still also it's a very David Lynchy movie, but it's also a movie, you know, like it's very odd, but you can follow the structure of it pretty easily. Whereas right. when you get to Mulholland Drive, it's kind of like,
what did I just watch?
Yeah, exactly. And I was saying to somebody the other day that, like, I kind of feel like there are ways to, even if you don't want to, even if you're the type of person that feels like going into a David Lynch movie, like, you're not going to be able to follow stuff, something like Mulholland Drive specifically, just because it is a notably bizarre David Lynch movie. You can kind of just find, you've got to find something in the first 20 minutes, excuse me, to grab hold of, like plot thread wise, and then just sort of follow that, you know, just look for things that relate to that. Don't worry about everything else that's going on, because I do find at the core of his movies, he does keep a most obvious through line, which still isn't necessarily obvious, but that if you are willing to sort of like just grab onto that, and in this case, it is the experience of Betty, and just hold on to that for the whole movie, then you can get a reading out of the movie pretty easily without having to research it furiously for 3 days like we did.
Yeah. You know?
And I do think like there is the most simple reading, and certainly the reading that I hold as the truth of the movie, it's pretty well spelled out, is that to an extent, like whether it's a dream or a reflection, it's Diane reflecting on how her life could have gone if she had been Betty and things had gone a little bit differently. And then she ends up killing her girlfriend, you know, or having her girlfriend killed. And I think, and then killing herself because of that guilt. I feel like that is the thing to grab onto and look for and watch for this movie, is the most basic plot line, you know?
Yeah, that's the one that makes the most sense, but even that, it's not all there. You know what I mean? There are still parts that, if we're looking at it through that lens, it's a pretty long line to draw between how that relates to, you know, that opening Winky's Diner scene.
Yep. Well, it's not,
I think it can be put together. And I think that seems to be the consensus, what you described as the most common interpretation. It's definitely the interpretation that makes the most sense to me. And when you watched again with that in mind, or you kind of reflect on a lot of the things that you had just seen with that in mind, it does make more sense, and it certainly strengthens a lot of scenes that maybe were strong but a little confusing, and just makes it that much more relatable in a way.
Yeah, for sure. And then with that narrative idea in your mind, then you are sort of able to look for more of a meaning in the movie, where I'm not inventing anything particularly exciting here. The movie does operate really well as sort of like, look at this beautiful, shiny place called Hollywood, and then let's go deeper and realize what this place actually is, that when you get under the surface of it, it is kind of this horrible place. And I mentioned Blue Velvet a number of times, and probably will for the rest of this podcast as well, because I feel like Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive are very much companion pieces, because Blue Velvet is all about looking deeper in suburbia. Like the very opening of the movie is this very stereotypical 1950s America, middle America suburbia. Like there's a guy holding onto a fire truck and waving at the camera as it drives by in slow motion, you know, and then the camera goes down to the grass and we hear this like terrifying sound of ants like scampering around in the grass. And it's kind of a horrifying moment. And that's the idea of Blue Velvet, is that just look under the surface of this suburbia, and what you get is a nightmare. And that's the same thing with Mulholland Drive. Like, look under the surface of Hollywood, and what you get is a potentially actual nightmare for Diane, Betty, Naomi Watts, whoever.
Yeah. No, I think that's, you're absolutely correct. That is really weaved throughout this. And I think a lot of people will bring up Sunset Boulevard, which is a movie whose, you know, the title of the movie follows the same template for Sunset Boulevard, Mulholland Drive. You literally see those words on the screen at some point in the movie. And yeah, we have examples of, you know, former actresses playing in both of those, or if I mean formerly very famous big actresses playing somewhat small roles in these movies, and both speak to what you were just mentioning about when the glamour fades from these, you know, very glimmery places, and the dreams people have about them versus the reality of what they experience there.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you want to talk about how this movie came to be?
Yeah, because it's really confusing.
It's such a hilarious story for any movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you put it with the product that came out of it, and it's so hilariously meta, and I find that fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I texted you about this. I just watched the Chinese Restaurant again, the Seinfeld episode, and there's a moment in that episode where George is telling the bathroom story and Jerry says to him, "This could only happen to you." And like reading about the history of Mulholland Drive and that seeing David Lynch's name, I'm like, this could only happen to you, you know? And that's how it feels. Like, it was made as a 90-minute pilot for ABC. And that's why there are so many varying threads or different characters like Adam. I would imagine if this movie starts out as a feature, Adam's character is small, even smaller than it is in the picture, but I assume he would have been a very important character in the television show. And so it was made as this 90-minute pilot that ABC, which is the network that had Twin Peaks, decided not to order it to series. And that inspired David Lynch. Well, that combined with I think Studio Canal offering $7 million to turn it into a movie, like write and shoot new stuff that can kind of tie it together and make it a narrative film. And
good job, David Lynch.
Sorry, make it a film as opposed to a pilot. And then release it. And that's what happened. And I mean, I've never really found... It seems like all of the ending stuff with Diane was new footage, but that's half an hour tops. So I still don't know what the other half hour of new stuff would have been, you know? And I don't even know if the quote-unquote 90-minute pilot was 90 minutes on television or like 90 minutes on television with commercials or 90 minutes full stop, you know? So I don't know. I mean, the nudity wouldn't have been in the television show, but other than that, I'm totally mystified by how this could have been a pilot in any capacity. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, as you said, the way that we have these threads that are pretty separate at the beginning makes a lot of sense if you're doing a murder mystery and, you know, you'd be pretty confused. I don't know how they would do a bit of different editing for a television. You'd be a bit confused, but with good filmmaking and good television making, you could be intrigued and you'd learn a little more and you'd kind of want to see how these things tie together, much like Twin Peaks. but yeah, I just find that story so fascinating. The notion of let's give you $7 million to kind of get to that end point in another hour, let's say, a film, and this to be the result of it. But
It is crazy. It doesn't make sense that a movie that I like as much as Mulholland Drive should have come out of that structure. Like, because everything we know about, or everything that we like to think about the way movies are made is through this auteurist lens. And it's not like this movie doesn't come through the auteurist lens, but that lens generally says that I am a person with an idea that makes this film, you know? Whereas with this, he was a person with an idea that made a television pilot that then got turned down and then had to be talked into adding more to it and then eventually made a film, you know? And it's just, and it also fits so well into the auteur theory of David Lynch's career. Like, it's, I don't know, it's baffling. It could only happen to him, you know?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting that the result is what we got. And reading about interviews with him talking about how he got from that 90-minute pilot to what ended up being the feature film Mulholland Drive, he said, I sat there one night and all these things just kind of came to me. And he described having all these really drawn out, you know, narrative storylines for what the television show is going to be and how everything went there and how they all tied together in more of a, what sounds like more of a classic television narrative style. Yeah. And then for him to have kind of this dream moment of how to make this very dreamlike film, I think is so interesting. And, you know, dreams and sleep are all over this movie, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the whole thing might be a dream, you know? I think there's a theory about that I would absolutely buy, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, we see someone sleeping early on, Rita sleeps a few times.
I mean, isn't the opening shot of the movie like bedsheets with no context? Or it's either the opening shot or after the jitterbug sequence before the credits.
I think it's before the jitterbug.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's what I mean. We have this setup that this could all be a dream. And then we have people sleeping. We have people talking about dreams early on, very early on as well, kind of giving you the idea that everything after this point, we've already planted the seed of this being a total dream slash nightmare. So be prepared for anything and kind of be ready to look at this in more of less of a B C D plot progression and more of a collage of ideas and moments and feelings and characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just with what we talked about, how it came together and then that setup, I think is very incredible too.
Absolutely. I think it probably ends up, I'm happy it ended up being a film because I can't imagine it would have been a TV show I would have liked as much as I like this movie. I think part of the joy of this movie comes from the fact that it is finite and specifically that turn that it takes in the last 25 to 30 minutes where just as he's starting to figure it out, everything changes.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's when the cowboy says it's time to wake up and just another idea that, okay, so we had someone sleeping at the beginning in a discussion about dreams. We had, you know, a good maybe 4/5 of this movie or 3/5 of this movie was a dream. And now you're waking up. And I mean, just to touch back to what you're saying about Hollywood, these are dreams about, you know, people who live dreams, you know, not only just the stories that Hollywood produces in their films, but the dream of moving to Hollywood and being part of that and being one of the people who makes these dreams for different people. And we see that in, you know, the young, naive Betty. And then we also see that in Adam's character being a director who is kind of the one making the dreams for people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But and then even he is having his dreams crushed, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He seems to be one of the most consistent characters in this movie, right? I mean, he kind of plays maybe slightly different versions of himself. And, you know, we kind of have this time jump that could apply to his story as well. But he seems to be somewhat more consistent. I mean, at least he keeps the same name throughout the film.
Yeah.
A favor in this one.
Yeah, exactly. We could actually call him Adam. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think at every point in the movie, I mean, there's only one scene where he's not, like he's still a director in that scene, but it's more, it focuses more on his personal life, the Billy Ray Cyrus scene. Every other scene that he's in the movie, we get him from, we see him from the position of the director, and he is in each of those scenes doing something that we could stereotypically or imagine a stereotypical director doing. He's in a meeting with producers talking about who he's going to cast and it's the lead in his film, finding out it's no longer his film. And then actually he's on sets a number of times. And then even at that dinner party sequence at the end, even after the turn has come, we still see him, canoodling with a co-star, which is something we've all, been conditioned to imagine that directors do, you know. So he's often shown in this very stereotypically directorial light, you know.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that if we look at this from the
I forgot the cowboy scene. I have no idea where to place the cowboy scene.
No one does, and the hotel scene.
Hotel scene. Oh yeah, yeah, fair
yeah. Enough. But I just if we look at it from. And I just think you can kind of look at his narrative in a somewhat straightforward fashion, at least relative to this movie, because we see him, you know, it's seemingly when we meet him, he's a pretty successful director. I mean, he's got a nice car and apparently walks around at the golf club. That's how rich he is and how much golf he can play. You know, he's receiving bad news and he's being told that his movie's being kind of taken out of his hands. But you know, if we look at this as he's made it so far and then to really be at the top, or not the top, but as high as you can go as a director, but still having to know your place within the system and still having, you know, financiers and studios and representatives who have control over you, you know, he pushes back and then things go terrible for him. Mm-hmm. And I think you can just see, you know, read between the lines and say he starts to accept it. And regardless of the way time jumps around, he goes from someone on the rise to someone showing that you can't rise any further without playing by these very rigid rules, and then accepting to play by those rules, and then being happy and, you know, getting the girl and being a successful director and seeming to be very rich and happy by the end of the film. Mm-hmm. So if we look at the way, you know, this movie depicts Hollywood, I think that says something about what you have to do to be successful within that system.
Exactly. And you kind of have to be on the upper end of things. Even if you're not the highest end of things, you have to be not at the Betty level of things.
Yeah. And accept that you're not going to, unless you are at the very, very top, there are things that outside of your artistic integrity and vision.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
You want to talk about Betty some?
Like Betty being Naomi Watts' performance? Because sure. yes is my answer. I love Naomi Watts in this movie. I love Naomi Watts in general. I think she's one of the most underrated actresses in Hollywood. Actors, actresses, whatever. I think she's so good in this. I think, again, we're going back to Gattaca. She's in that sort of Jude Law category of actors where she's such a good character actor that is also so good looking that she doesn't necessarily get to be the character actor all the time. Although she has sort of found her way into more recently having smaller roles and she's good in everything. Like, I think she is an actress that everybody knows is good in everything, but never really thinks about her. This is a movie that she does a lot of those wonderful things in all throughout. I think it's such a tough performance to give, and I think she's basically perfect in this movie. Yeah,
it's never too kind of small city girl for you, at least initially.
I mean, it's that, but that's like also a David Lynch thing, you know? Like, it's
a lot of archetypes, really.
Exactly. Like, she comes into the movie playing a perfect David Lynch character, you know? Like, and then towards the end of the movie, as she gets more depressing or gets more depressed, and her performance is a more realistic performance of being so depressed. Like, it's also like legitimate acting chops, you know, because there's like different styles of acting that she shows in this movie. She shows the David Lynch style of acting early on where your lines are really weird. There's like some weird turns of phrase throughout, and you take pauses at weird times. And then she acts like she's in a normal movie towards the end and does a really, really good job of it. And some people can't do both. A lot of people can't do both. And she's perfect at both of them, you know? So, like, it is I think it's a really difficult performance that she's able to do really well. And to go back to your original question, no, I don't think she's too over the top at the beginning, because I think that's what the movie asks of her.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, that's a good answer. It's also fun watching actors be good actors.
Oh, like her audition scene is so good.
Yeah, it's something else, eh?
Oh, it's amazing. And the best part of the scene, other than the performance, I guess, is the fact that almost all of it is delivered in one unbroken close-up. There are a couple quick cuts in the middle of it, or at two different points of it, either to cover up the fact that they switched takes or just that they didn't like something in the close-up for a little brief period of time. But the fact that the majority of that sequence is shown just in a close-up without a cut, it probably goes a minute without a cut at one point, and it just really draws you in more. And it really is a good scene. And the fact that she totally flips within that scene a couple of times is really impressive.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I mean, watching people within a scene have those quick turns.
Yeah.
That's always been so impressive to me. And it is just such a quick change when she does decide to do it. And yeah, I just don't think everyone, even professional actors, are capable of that. So it's always lovely to see.
Yeah, exactly.
So you talked a little bit about the shot length and the close up and stuff.
Yeah.
What about visually for you? How does this movie stack up?
I mean, times it kind of looks cheap, you know, like
it's not that expensive.
No, exactly. But it doesn't. It does look like something that started on TV. Like, it looks like it would have been a very expensive television show, but it also still looks like it would have been a television show, you know? And this is, again, in the pre-Sopranos world.
What comes to mind for looking like that?
For looking like this TV show? Yeah. Like ER probably would be a
I mean parts of this movie.
Oh, just in general, the cinematography, like, I think David Lynch prefers the 2.35 to 1 ratio in general. At least Blue Velvet's coming to mind, and that's what that's in. Although I guess he alternates a little bit. I don't know. There's just something. It's certainly not shot in anamorphic. You get some really cheap looking lens flares in the streetlights. excuse me, which I think is an accidental comment on the level of camera equipment they were working with. Just in general, it doesn't look like they had tons of money, because there's just not a lot of wide angle camera work as well. Yeah, just the general feel of it is not super expensive, and also something that started on a baseline of we have to be able to do one of these a week, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah. When you have to work on a faster schedule like you do in TV, even when you're making a pilot and you have to plan to continue to work on a faster schedule, it just speeds everything up, which makes everything look less rehearsed and a little bit cheaper, you know? Which is not to say this movie, whatever, it doesn't matter. So the visuals of the movie, the things I do like, my favorite shot in the movie probably is the one where we start in the close-up of the woman singing, I forget the name of the song, but in that studio, and then the camera pulls out and we get that big crane shot. And it's what I've been talking about for representing this movie as a whole, where we start with looking at this very beautiful woman singing this, or lip syncing this song well. And it's just this very pleasant thing. And then the camera pulls out and you see all the artifice that goes on behind it. And you see all the dirt and the dust and the various people running around doing various jobs. And what you get in that one shot is you get the product that Hollywood is putting out to you, and then eventually you get how that product puts it out to you. Like you are able to see the product on its own, and then also the world that creates it, you know, which is exactly what this movie is about. It's about Betty getting drawn into that world that she thinks exists, and then finding out all of these other people exist and all these other elements of it exist. You know?
Yeah, no, that take is wonderful. And yeah, I mean, further with what you were saying, it's, we get a shot of this woman who you think, you know, is very good looking, has this beautiful voice. She's singing the song about love. And then, you know, as you said, we pull out and we see that it's just the artifice of it. And so not only do we see that not just this woman singing, but she's singing in a recording booth making this product, and then a bit further back, even that is a product, you know, this is part of a movie. And then we see, you know, the set and everything around it. Mm-hmm. And then we go on to find that girl is just expendable. Like, we're never gonna see that girl again. she doesn't make the movie, even though she kind of has the look and maybe the talent. That's that. And you know, kind of these feelings you get about her and her voice and the song, in, you know, that brief moment, that's all for naught. That's all washed away when we just get the next girl in here. The next young, good-looking girl can come in, and we can forget about that one now. And if that's not Hollywood, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. And even, I mean, it's not in that exact take, but right after that take ends, pretty much, you get Adam and her having a wonderfully fake Hollywood conversation where they're both saying things that they're clearly not thinking at that moment. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's definitely my favorite shot. That's one moment in the movie where I think the filmmaking, like visual filmmaking, is really spectacular. I like the way that the conversation, the first conversation in the diner is shot, the sort of floating camera.
That's such a weirdly arresting scene for, I mean, up. I know obviously at the end there's a jump scare, but I think that does such a good job of being very immediate and effective, considering it's
considering
two people
what
talking
the
in a diner.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Two people we've never met and who are clearly not going to be the leads of this movie, just because we have no idea who these people are, these actors are. They're clearly character actors.
Now he's standing by the counter just like he said he would be.
Yeah. And the lead up to that jump scare at the end, how he's like taking his time, he looks at the entrance sign, looks at the payphone, all that stuff is good. And the sound in that scene is really good. David Lynch in general is spectacular. The sound in his movies is always spectacular. But yeah, that whole sequence is like, I don't understand where that scene is supposed to fit in the movie. I don't understand what I'm supposed to think about that scene, but I'm certain it's the key to the movie. You know, like, I'm certain that's the scene that matters the most, and it's the scene I understand the least. And it also is one of my favorite scenes, you know, and it's so, I don't know, it's just, it's impossible to articulate. Like, I love the scene. I don't know what it means, but I know it's important. You know, like, I don't know. I sound like a buffoon, but that's but going back to the visuals thing, like, that floating camera is cool. And I think the fact that it is shot that way is, which would lead people to think that, oh, this is a dream. The floating camera is the dream, you know? That's kind of makes me feel like I'm supposed to think that it's reality. Like, because David Lynch would know that when he's shooting that on set. Everybody working on one of his movies would know that, you know? And so I feel like it's part of the reality, but the whole movie might not be reality.
This might just be another scene in it.
Exactly. I think what I'm asking you is what is reality, James? Please tell me. Like, in general. Define reality for me.
I'm not doing this. I like the scene of right after the limo crash when, who we will later come to call Rita, you know, cuts through the trees, and then she's sort of more down in the city, away from the hills. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of in the middle of the street, sort of on a boulevard, and there's all the high trees. It's a pretty wide shot, and we get this kind of light coming in from the upper left. She's just pretty small. It reminds me a lot of the cover of The Exorcist, actually. I thought that was a really, really nice shot.
Okay, yeah, I can recall that.
Yeah, and another, it's not so much what's depicted, just the way that it's done it, which I mentioned earlier as one kind of just filmmaking thing that I enjoyed a lot, is one time Betty's on the phone with her aunt discussing Rita, mm-hmm. and we get another kind of floating camera moment as she's we have a POV shot of someone walking through the house, and we assume that it's, or at least I assume that it's going to be, this is Betty's view because she's the one talking, and she's the one that we're kind of relating to more at this point. And then the door opens and we see Betty there. And, mm-hmm. It ends up, we had been watching Rita's point of view this whole time. And so we expect to see Rita when she opens the door, but it's Betty, and we thought we were Betty at this moment. And it kind of just takes that 1 second to piece things together. And there's, you know, for me at least, just this one kind of unsettling second, well, one of many in this movie overall, but this 1 second where our expectations of filmmaking have kind of led us to believe one thing, and then they're subverted, and it's not a big jump scare, and that doesn't turn into anything, you know, violent or grotesque or anything, but it's just kind of one more moment to keep you on the edge of this movie and to reinforce that very few things in this movie are going to be what you expect them to be.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I would agree.
Good.
Yeah. I love the idea of somebody seeing Mulholland Drive for the first time, going in with expectations and being 100% right about them. I love the idea of that being able to happen.
Oh, you know? Miniature grandparent suicide. Called it. Called it. Telegraph that one.
Most predictable filmmaker in the history of Hollywood, unquestionably. Yeah.
Okay, so I wrote down
the word what followed by a question mark a lot of times.
I wrote down the word espresso and then LOL.
And then I also wrote down, where has Dan Hedaya gone? Oh, come man. Back to me, Dan Hedaya.
Listen to our Clueless podcast for my love for Dan Hedaya. Yeah. No, I wrote down what we touched on a little bit before about what we're supposed to read as kind of the consensus interpretation of this movie.
Yeah,
it's a bit more fleshed out. I wanted to see what if you had any further elucidations on it or anything slightly different than kind of what I had been gathering.
You know, I love it elucidating. Let's go.
Okay, so Diane is a real person. If anything, this movie's real. Okay, yeah. We'll just go with this.
Yes. Okay. I'm glad we have that qualifier. Now I agree with that sentence.
Okay. So Diane is a real person. She looks like Naomi Watts. And basically the last, as I said, 1/5 or 2/5 of this movie is real. Mm-hmm. So the things that happen before that are kind of, you know, either a dream or an imagination of coming from this real character. Mm-hmm. She believes that she is in something like a movie like romance with Camilla Rhodes, aka Rita, mm-hmm. who is her another more successful actress than she is and someone that she had a relationship with. And most of what we see at the beginning is sort of a fantasy she had where Rita is this helpless helpless woman who depends on her, which is a kind of a unhealthy love fantasy from Diane's point. Mm-hmm. And sort of as an actress, Diane only really knows falling in love through some kind of typical Hollywood narrative. So that's why we have, you know, this caper with the stacks of cash and the key and the amnesia and, you know, a bit of the hitman plot that we get into in the beginning. And this one's a bit more tenuous, but we have this idea that Diane may have paid someone to kill Camilla, mm-hmm. and she's dealing with a lot of the regret of that result. So maybe the actual hitman behavior is a bit of a stretch. Maybe it was only a breakup. But is something like that similar to what you think we as a culture are kind of agreeing with this movie is about as much as we can?
Yeah. I mean, I said I love elucidating, but I have nothing to add. So, like, I agree with that, you know? I don't really have any further additions to it. I think that's correct.
So what about the box and the key?
She's opening the box of reality. By figuring out how to look into that box, it takes us to reality. It takes us to where we are in the present tense.
Yeah, because that's the last thing that really happens before, you know, the cowboy tells her to wake up and where what we think is reality really begins, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's the best I've got.
Yeah, and we have that moment where she asks what the key is going to open to the hitman, mm-hmm. who says, you know, who basically just laughs, but says, when the hit's done, I'm going to give you this key, and then you're going to know. And the only way that I could look at that is, you know, she opens this key. The key is the signifier that Camilla is now gone, either through, a murder for hire system or maybe more simply just a breakup. Mm-hmm. And with the key, she's able to open the box and see what is left, and it's nothing, and it's a total absence of Camilla or Rita, and she's alone. And I think that that's kind of the most terrifying thing for her, someone in Hollywood who nobody wants, you know, the idea that you go there with these dreams of being famous and desired and important and expensive, and somehow these things get away from you and you're left alone, and that's what's in the box, and that's what we never see it, but it, you know, it falls to the floor with some serious gravity, as though there is something in it. And mm-hmm. the thing in it is very, you know, has a certain gravity of its own, but it's the complete absence of all the things you came to Hollywood to look for.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. And also the fact that, the Rita chooses her name off of Rita Hayworth, who's an icon of old Hollywood. And, and Betty has very much been seduced by her image of old Hollywood, and now she's seduced by this further image of old Hollywood, you know. And I think that adds a little bit to your point, as that yes, it is, it's all nothing now, you know.
Like, so. Awesome.
Yeah.
Good. Good, good.
Yeah.
Crack that case.
Yeah, exactly.
Any more brainbusters, David Lynch?
Yeah. I mean, there are 500 more in this film.
No, I know. It's insane. Like, and I could ask them, and from what I understand, he'd love to hear questions and never answers any of them.
Yeah.
And if gives you anything, is just more questions.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like David Lynch would be... Like, the idea of meeting somebody like David Lynch that isn't actually also the real David Lynch would, like, drive me crazy. Because I feel like, you know the Community reference I'm going to drop, but, like, he's the type of person that would say, and this is the line that Jeff Winger says as a joke in Community, can you ever really own a horse? David Lynch would say that for real, and I'd be like, oh, that's an interesting question, David.
Can you ever really direct a film?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly like the type of shit that he would say. And it would drive me bananas if it was somebody that hadn't also made at least three really great movies.
He's earned it.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, it's just... He's a tough nut to crack. Nobody except, like, seemingly Laura Dern, who seems to be one of his best friends, has been able to crack it. I don't understand the man, and I still love trying to figure him out, but I'm never going to.
No, and I think this movie for all it says about Hollywood and dreams. And it does just kind of raise the question of what a movie is and can be. And that's why I say I don't know how to feel about it, because I might just be too used to comparing it to other, you know, other narrative films that are just more linear and cohesive. But if it can have a profound effect on you and give you as many feelings and questions as it does, then, you know, that seems to be enough.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this movie is constantly playing on what it knows we know about what the act of watching a movie, you know, like what we naturally will get attached to, like we will naturally gravitate towards the kind seeming blonde that is arriving to Hollywood for the first time. And also the first character that we are really introduced to, the person that avoids being murdered, that we will just sort of attach ourselves to them, and even Adam to a little extent, just because he's clearly in that room where we meet him. He's the person that is the most like us, because he is the one not wearing a suit, and the one not spitting up espresso, and the one that's not Dan Hedaya, you know? And
But so much to that point, I mean, we have Laura Harding, we have, you know, Rita before she's Rita, we have this blank slate, we have this woman who's trying to be detective, who's trying to piece together a movie that, you know, or piece together her thread of this movie that we are not able to piece together at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of playing detective for this film, not just within this film. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we begin to relate to her so easily, and the way that she takes out of being so lost is to say Rita Hayworth, is to say this old Hollywood thing. And it kind of gives us the chance to say, oh, well, then I'll just look at this movie through the same old Hollywood lens that is normally what happens when I'm sitting down and watching a movie on a screen. And just how bad of advice that can be, is to look at everything through that lens.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And one thing we haven't really talked about, I mean, we've barely talked about the Silencio club, but that scene on its own is constantly playing with when we see people seeing a stage show, we assume it's live, right? Just like when we see a movie, we assume it's all being recorded. But like in the best case scenario, like in that audition scene we talked about, the mechanisms of the film sort of disappear from you and allow you to get further drawn into it. And that stage show is pointing out to us a handful of times that it is it's a recording that people are lip syncing along with. It's not a real live performance, vocally at least. And then we get I believe her name's Rebecca Del Rio singing a song, and that sequence goes on for long enough that
you start to trust it.
Exactly. And you totally forget that.
He literally said that all of this is an illusion about a minute ago.
Exactly. And like, but the scene is done well enough that it draws you in. It draws Rita and Betty still into it, and like they kind of are just so drawn into it. And then when the woman Rebecca Del Rio falls over, the song continues, but the emotion of it is gone, because you are able to see what that emotion was propped up by. You know, like, you know, it's all artifice, and that's what leads her Betty into her bag to look at the box, which we in a later scene find contains nothing, you know, and or contains emptiness. And I just think that scene is so good at pointing out so many things about this movie, that both the good things about this movie and things about movies in general, where they all rely on machinations and all this artifice. But in the best case scenario, you're forgetting them for a minute, and the only thing that will break you out of that trance is when something falters, you know. And I think that's something that Mulholland Drive doesn't do frequently. It is kind of this trance-like thing, and when it turns hard, and it hits you pretty hard, because you've been drawn into the trance. And it's why the movie's so confusing, because you buy into so many things even though you don't necessarily understand them. And then when it gets to the point where we are now told that Betty is Diane, we're just so confused by it, but also kind of want to figure it out. And I think it makes the ending extremely horrifying. And for a movie that doesn't feature a lot of traditional horror scenes, I think it's a really good horror movie. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thanks for listening to our podcast about Mulholland Drive. Hopefully it is comprehensible. So yeah, check out our website for more. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.